Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
After Oppenheimer's success at the Oscars, why not delve into the history of the atomic bomb and key characters from that period of history with a podcast? The Bomb, from the BBC World Service, explores the race to beat the Nazis in developing the atomic bomb and the scientists and spies who changed history. Listen to the whole series now by searching for The Bomb wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Where to Be a Woman is the podcast celebrating the best of women's well-being.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and at 14 hours GMT on Wednesday the 13th of March, these are our main stories. An ally of Alexei Navalny accuses Vladimir Putin of ordering a hammer attack.
Listen, it was a pleasure to read everything you wrote to me. It's a double pleasure to read this and realise that I'm still alive.
The Russian election in occupied Ukraine.
What kind of an election is it when there are two locals, one holding a list of voters and the other a ballot box, and a military man with a machine gun?
And reports of another mass kidnapping in Nigeria. Also in this podcast, the sound of a coral reef.
We've been listening to recordings from different reefs, and we've noticed these healthy reefs seem to have really distinct acoustic signatures that differ from what we see on highly degraded or impacted reefs.
Start this podcast in Lithuania, where the president has accused Russia of a pre-planned assault after one of its citizens, a close aide to the late Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny, was attacked with a meat hammer outside his home in Vilnius. Leonid Volkov has been speaking for the first time since being discharged from hospital, looking pretty battered at his home in the Lithuanian capital with his arm in a sling. He said the attack was a greeting from Putin.
Привет, друзья. Я дома.
Hello, friends. I'm home. Thank you very much for your words of support. It's hard. It's okay. We can handle it. Listen, it was a pleasure to read everything you wrote to me. And it's a double pleasure to read this and realize that I'm still alive. They wanted to chop me with a meat hammer. A man right outside my house, in the yard, attacked me and hit me in the leg 15 times. It's obvious that this was such an obvious, typical, characteristic gangster greeting from Putin, from gangster St. Petersburg, Vladimir Vladimirovich. Greetings to you. What else can I say? Something needs to be done, right?
I heard more from our Eastern Europe correspondent, Sarah Rainsford.
Leonid Volkov is a very close associate of Alexei Navalny, who, of course, died in prison in Russia a few weeks ago, last month. Volkov was his chief of staff for many years. He's a very close friend. He is an absolutely instrumental part of the Navalny team, who are the vast majority of them now living in exile, many of them in Lithuania. In fact, Leonid Volkov moved some years ago for his own safety. He was facing a number of politically motivated criminal charges in Russia. He had been working from Lithuania primarily to make sure that the Navalny team as a whole could carry on doing their work, their anti-corruption investigations and their opposition activity when it was becoming more and more difficult in Russia. And as the conditions in Russia became impossible for activists because Navalny's team was declared extremist and banned, more and more activists from that team then moved to Lithuania to join their sort of headquarters in exile in Vilnius. So I think this will be particularly shocking for them because, of course, they moved to Lithuania to be safe, and this looks like they can't guarantee that safety. So it was a pretty vicious attack, but he has said that he will continue his activism, so will the whole team. They won't surrender, which of course is a catchphrase from Alexei Navalny himself.
Is there any opposition at all left?
Alexei Navalny's team is pretty much entirely outside Russia now. Inside Russia, it's extremely difficult. There are three candidates, in theory, on the ballot paper for Sunday's election, other than Vladimir Putin, but none of them are genuine opposition characters. And in fact, some of them openly support Vladimir Putin. So in that sense, no, the main opposition parties have all been sidelined over the years, and all vocal opposition has been crushed in the last 2.5 decades of Vladimir Putin's rule. So it's basically dangerous to be in open political opposition to Vladimir Putin today. Some people do still try. There was a couple of candidates who tried to be genuine opposition candidates in the presidential election, but their path was predictably blocked and they weren't able to register. The Electoral Commission intervened and said that their signatures of support were not genuine and therefore they weren't registered. So it's difficult, it's dangerous, and as you can see, it's even dangerous outside Russia itself.
Sarah Rainsford with me from Warsaw. The attack on Mr. Volkov came just days before Russia's presidential election. Mr. Putin, of course, is nailed on to win. But even so, Moscow will try to make the results as credible as possible. Not just with a large turnout in Russia itself, but also by pressuring voters in parts of occupied Ukraine, where polling is already underway. Here's Vitaly Shevchenko.
Let me tell you about Russia, my friend. Says a song playing at a polling station in the occupied part of Ukraine's Kherson region. And this election says a lot about Russia under Vladimir Putin. He is certain to win, he is firmly in control of the electoral system, and all of his most outspoken critics are in jail, exiled, or dead. A high turnout would help the Kremlin's efforts to legitimise Putin's continued rule and justify the war in Ukraine. There's a variety of ways in which Ukrainians under occupation are being coerced into voting. First, they're visited at home by pro-vote campaigners, often accompanied by armed men. Then, even though polling stations exist, they're not required to visit them, as the occupation authorities are also dispatching people with ballot boxes to their homes. This is how such visits work.
Uncle Valera, hello. This is voting at home. Get your passport and come out here.
Ukrainians have already come under considerable pressure to adopt Russian passports, but Ukrainian passports are accepted as proof of ID to make voting even easier. Residents have been sent text messages informing them of the dates of the vote, and tried and tested Soviet methods are also being deployed to attract them to polling stations, such as the offer of free concerts and food. One resident of Kherson region, the southeastern part of which is occupied by Russian forces, described to the BBC how voting was organised in his village. We are unable to disclose his name or location due to security concerns, and his words are read by someone else.
Pro-Russian locals visit households with ballot boxes, accompanied by armed military men. If they knock and no one opens, they move on to the next house. This is ridiculous. What kind of an election is it when there are two locals, one holding a list of voters and the other a ballot box, and a military man with a machine gun? This isn't democracy. It is a comedy show.
Ukraine has dismissed the vote as an illegitimate sham, and those involved in organising it have been targeted. For example, on the 6th of March, a local woman helping the Russian administration hold the election died in a car bombing in the occupied town of Berdyansk in Zaporizhia region. I asked the region's Ukrainian governor, Ivan Fedorov, who was responsible for the attack.
Some heroes. Great cooperation between our resistance inside temporarily occupied territories and our secret services and special services on territory of Ukraine.
Most see this poll as just an endorsement of Vladimir Putin and his efforts to annex these regions. And if you do not support him, you should stay quiet or leave.
Now, Russia has reported another wave of drone attacks by Ukraine. The Kremlin's defense ministry says it shot down 58 drones overnight across six regions in Russia. There were some reported injuries. The Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, said this was in retaliation for Russian attacks on his country. Kiev-backed forces have warned residents of the border regions with Russia to evacuate. I spoke to our Ukraine correspondent, James Waterhouse.
It's the second time in as many days that Ukraine has launched a fairly large-scale series of drone attacks on Russia. We've spoken to sources at the country's security service who say the aim in targeting three oil refineries on the border with Ukraine was to target Russia's economy, essentially its ability to make money from energy and fund its continued invasion of Ukraine. Now, President Zelensky may frame this politically as revenge for the airstrikes his country constantly endures at the hands of Russia. But it's clear when you look at what the Russian officials are acknowledging, that there was damage in at least two of these oil refineries, which includes some of the biggest plants in the country. It seems that these drones have left a mark. But in addition to that, we're told by Russian officials in the city of Belgorod, close to the border, that the FSB, the Federal Security Service HQ, was also targeted by a drone. So I think as far as Ukraine is concerned, it will be almost satisfied with what is going on. As far as Vladimir Putin of Russia is concerned, in a recent interview with State TV, he's accused of Ukraine of trying to interfere with the upcoming presidential elections. As we speak, there are also pro-Ukrainian Russian military groups which have made an incursion, who claim to still be fighting in a village there. So Russia certainly has a headache on its own territory whilst continuing to try and occupy as much of Ukraine as possible.
A lot of focus in recent days on these border areas. I'm just seeing flashing up on the news wires that civilians have been told to leave these areas on the border between Ukraine and Russia.
Yes, and this is part of the almost psychological objective that Ukraine hopes to achieve, because it is manufacturing its own drones. Yes, that is something it has been looking to develop. But it is unable to, when you look at what Russia inflicts on Ukraine, but it can sometimes launch more than 150 drones and missiles in one go to overwhelm air defences. This is Ukraine trying to apply psychological pressure to the Russians that can, you know, live their lives and turn a blind eye to what is going on across the border. So that will feed into that as well for Kyiv, no doubt.
James Waterhouse with me from Kyiv. They are the three best-known stripes in design history, but Adidas has reported more annual losses. The German sportswear giant reported a drop in profits after sales were hit by their decision to stop working with the rapper Kanye West and his Yeezy brand. Here's Jessica Wilkins.
La, la, yeah. La, la, wait till I get my money right.
Sportswear brand Adidas has run into trouble, posting another drop in its annual profits. The loss of $82 million followed a profit of $668 million for Adidas the previous year.
God, I'll be back in a second. Man, it's so hard not to act reckless. The whole much is giving money.
Sales were hit by the brand's decision to cut ties with the rapper Kanye West, after he made anti-Semitic comments on social media. His tweets also got him suspended from Instagram and X. At the time, Adidas, a German company which profited under the Nazis, said it had to face up to its historic responsibilities and ended its partnership with Mr. West. This has hit sales in the United States, where Mr. West's Yeezy trainers were particularly popular. Yeezy trainers were estimated to bring in $2 billion every year for Adidas. The sports brand is still selling its remaining inventory of Yeezy trainers.
Excuse me, was you saying something? You can't tell me nothing.
Now, there are few more powerful symbols of ecological devastation than degraded or disappearing coral reefs. A paper for the Royal Society Open Science Journal made an astonishing discovery. Coral reefs have their own soundscapes, an active acoustic environment. And there's more. If you play the sounds of healthy coral reefs to unhealthy coral reefs, it helps them repair things. Nadej Aoki from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution told my colleague Amal Rajan why coral reefs matter.
Coral reefs provide habitat for more than a quarter of all marine species, so they're huge hubs of biodiversity, and they're also really important to human communities because of their structure. So reefs actually, when there are powerful storm surges or waves, a lot of that energy is absorbed by the 3D structure of the reefs, and they help to protect our coastal communities.
What kinds of sounds are on healthy coral reefs? And how did you find out that unhealthy ones were listening to different sounds?
So a healthy reef is going to have a lot of different types of sound on it. And the ones that we think are really important are these biological sounds produced by fishes and invertebrates primarily. We know this because we've been listening to coral reefs for, in my laboratory group, about 10 years now. We've been listening to recordings from different reefs, and we've noticed these healthy reefs seem to have really distinct acoustic signatures that differ from what we see on highly degraded or impacted reefs.
Fascinating. It's so interesting. So what happened when you put a speaker on a reef and started to play back recordings from other healthy reefs?
So what we were able to observe by putting that speaker down and actually having it play sound in the vicinity of larval corals by playing underwater sounds to those larvae on a degraded reef that didn't have those natural sound cues, we were able to induce that settlement behavior at much higher rates than we were observing naturally without the sound enrichment.
What's going on there? Why are they responding to the sound? Is it because don't anthropomorphize this at all, which is obviously a danger, but what is it about the sounds that's inducing them to settle and to reproduce?
So I'll say we really don't know yet. This is such a behavior that we're only just now characterizing in corals. We do observe this in other marine species, in larval fishes, larval oysters. So sound is a really important sensory cue for a lot of these animals, and it's likely indicating to them something about the environment or the habitat that is positive for them.
And the hope in the long term is that this is part of efforts to restore coral reefs, but obviously not the whole solution, because the whole solution would involve fundamentally not changing their environment with warmer oceans and so on.
Yes, exactly. I think what we're really trying to do is give these baby corals kind of the best shot and the best head start at getting a foothold back on these reefs and helping them to recover on their own. But if we are not able to stop the rise of marine heat waves, of overfishing, of all of these other things that are really impacting reefs, obviously there's not a lot else that we can do to prevent them from continuing to downslide.
Still to come on this podcast.
They are the biggest organisms on Earth, and they're some of the oldest organisms on Earth. So we hold them in a regard of kind of exotic species.
How giant redwood trees are flourishing in the UK.
It all started with me asking my friends and family to write letters to my daughter Coco, sharing their experiences and giving her advice for her life ahead. The idea blossomed into Dear Daughter from the BBC World Service, the podcast where, with the help of your letters, I'm creating a handbook to life full of advice for daughters everywhere. Listen now by searching for Dear Daughter wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Dear Daughter.
New figures from the United Nations suggest child mortality is at a historic low. Despite progress, it's estimated that nearly 5 million children die before their fifth birthday somewhere in the world every year. Lily Caprani from the UN Children's Agency UNICEF was involved in compiling the study, and she's been talking to James Copnall.
I wouldn't say that that's cause for celebration. 4.9 million children dying before they reach their fifth birthday is still an unacceptable tragedy, but it does mean that we're starting to make progress in the right direction. And quite often, these are children dying of entirely preventable causes. Basic healthcare systems, like having a skilled birth attendant, a trained midwife at the birth of a baby, can make all the difference in saving lives. Or just having the most basic access to things like oral rehydration salts if a baby gets diarrhea, or having antibiotics if they have an infection. But too many babies and mums are missing out on having those basic things, and they're still dying unnecessarily every year.
So where there has been progress, what are the principal fields that you see it coming in?
Well, there's been progress across the world. There is good news. Over the course of the last generation, we've seen a huge drop in the number of babies, especially very young babies, dying unnecessarily in their first few days and weeks of life. But progress hasn't been even around the world. There are many countries in sub-Saharan Africa in particular where there are communities, very low-income households where mothers are not receiving even the most basic access to healthcare or any care when they're pregnant.
It sounds then that economics, financing, funding is one of the key issues here. And so if almost 5 million babies still are dying before, or children below the age of five are still dying, that would suggest that perhaps this issue doesn't have the sort of global level of interest it should.
Well, it's true that money can make a difference in terms of making sure that healthcare workers have the drugs they need, the vaccines they need, all the basic equipment. But actually, the way to deliver the life-saving basic treatment that a pregnant mum needs or a newborn baby needs is often through a community healthcare worker that is not an expensive thing to provide. There are a couple of examples of countries that have made huge progress just in the last few years. Places like Malawi and Rwanda have shown just what you can achieve when you get organised and have a community healthcare worker system locally so that those mums are getting attention early on. And it hasn't been through enormous injections of cash so much as organizing the health system around this community healthcare workforce. And it's managed to bring down the number of babies dying by more than 75%. Really amazing. It shows just what can be done when we really focus in on the issue and use the evidence about what we know will work.
Lily Caprani from UNICEF. Just days after more than 250 children were abducted from a school in northwest Nigeria, there are reports that dozens of people have been kidnapped from a village in the same state, Kaduna. Chris Iwokor is in Abuja, the Nigerian capital, and gave me this update.
The abductors invaded the community, surrounded some homes and went from house to house, picking family members. Some of them, they were woken up because it was around midnight. And most of them, because of the prevailing heat in Nigeria, were not really properly dressed. They had very few clothes on and they were led, you know, like that into the bush. A family member has told us that at least six members of his family were abducted. And at the moment, the authorities haven't said anything about it, but it adds to the growing concerns over the security situation, not just in Kaduna State, but across the country, as concerns grow over the whereabouts of the nearly 300 school children that were abducted on Thursday last week.
Well, other kidnappings as well that have happened in Nigeria, as we were talking about on Saturday.
Exactly. In the northeast Nigeria, there was this incident of some IDPs, internally displaced persons, who were kidnapped, nearly 200 of them, mostly women and girls, who were abducted by suspected Boko Haram fighters. The government hasn't said if they've discovered their location at the moment. That was the first mass abduction before that of the Kuriga school children. And then just days after that, there was also the incident of the abduction of about 15 students from a school, an Islamic school in Sokoto State, also in northwest Nigeria. And these are actually adding to growing concerns and safety of people, not just in the north of the country, but across Nigeria. Many people are wondering why this mass abduction, growing and continuing, and how large numbers of people could be kidnapped and led into the bush without being detected by security forces.
Chris Iwokor in Abuja. It's the first rematch since 1956. President Joe Biden, former President Donald Trump have sealed their party's nominations for November's US election. Both candidates secured the support of enough delegates in primary contests in several states on Tuesday. Sarah Smith reports.
America is set for a repeat of the 2020 election, as both Joe Biden and Donald Trump have now secured enough votes to each claim their party's presidential nomination. Mr. Biden said he was honoured that Democrats had put their faith in him at a moment when the threat to the nation posed by Mr. Trump is greater than ever. The president had faced minimal opposition from other candidates, even though many in his own party do worry about his age and his electability. Donald Trump's domination of the Republican Party has been confirmed, as he's won every state primary so far except for one in Vermont.
Admiring the biggest trees on the planet, the giant redwoods, is a staple for any tourist in California. Now they're thriving in the UK, at least according to a new survey. Here's our science editor, Rebecca Morell.
Giant redwoods were brought to the UK 160 years ago. They were the ultimate botanical status symbol for the Victorians. Now a new study suggests the UK's damp mild weather suits them, and they're flourishing there. It's estimated there are 500,000 of these giants towering above the treetops in the UK. Professor Matt Disney from University College London is one of the new study's authors.
They are the biggest organisms on Earth, and they're some of the oldest organisms on Earth. So we hold them in a regard of kind of exotic species. And so they've been planted all over the place, sometimes in perhaps not such sensible places. But it means you see them cropping up in the backs of houses and churches and streets and parks, and people are planting more of them.
The UK trees outnumber the redwoods in their native range in California, where there are fewer than 80,000 trees, and they're also at risk from climate change. But the trees in the UK aren't yet as tall as their American counterparts. In California, they can grow to 90 metres. In Britain, the tallest is just shy of 55 metres. But that's because in terms of age, the trees are still very young. It's thought giant redwoods can live for more than 2,000 years, so there's still plenty of time for the UK's trees to reach even headier heights.
The BBC has secured rare access to a tiny village in the heart of the demilitarised zone, the strip of land separating North and South Korea. There, a small community of South Koreans live within metres of the North, meaning they must be guarded day and night by hundreds of soldiers. The village was established at the end of the Korean War as a symbol of peace. But 70 years on, the peninsula is still divided, and in the past year, tensions between the North and South have flared. As hopes of reunification fade, the village's days seem numbered. Our Seoul correspondent Jean McKenzie spent 3 days with the US-led coalition army that runs the village.
At 85 years old, Mrs. Kim still tends to her fields. She's checking her cabbages, which she'll eventually turn into kimchi.
One day, I was picking up acorns over there, and I saw North Korean soldiers. I started screaming. It was so scary.
Do you pay much attention to whether relations between North and South Korea are good or bad?
No, we live with our backs to each other, so I don't think about it much.
But the residents have once again found themselves on the front line of escalating tensions between the North and South. Earlier this year, Kim Jong-un said the peaceful reunification of the two countries was no longer possible and branded South Korea his number one enemy. We've walked 10 minutes now out of Taesong through the countryside to one of the fields on the very outskirts, right up next to the North Korean border, where one of the residents is harvesting the end of his rice. He has to be accompanied by two heavily armed soldiers with machine guns. They are dressed entirely in camouflage, even their faces are covered. From here, the mayor takes us up to the border. We're so close to North Korea now that I could just hear North Korean people singing in the fields over there. And there are no fences along this line that is separating the two countries, which means there is nothing to physically stop people from walking over into these fields and then on into the village. No! No!
안녕하세요. 주민체크 왔습니다.
As darkness descends, the threat from North Korea rises, and the soldiers are now going door to door to check everyone's at home. The villagers need permission to go outside after 7 o'clock. This curfew is the most restrictive part of village life here. It's the following morning, and I've come to meet the Shin family as their two young children are getting ready for school. They're a bit of an anomaly here because over the years, many young people have left the village, lured by the bright lights and opportunities of modern-day South Korea, and the population is dwindling.
The curfew is the hardest thing about living here, especially when you're young and you want to go out and have fun.
Do you think young people can be convinced to stay here?
I don't think it will be easy. It's asking a lot of young people.
The Shin children attend the village primary school, but there are now so few children here, most its pupils are bussed in from outside.
Would you be sad if your children decided that they didn't want to return to the village and live here?
I didn't.
No, I want them to live outside the village, in society. I want them to travel and have lots of experiences.
Not only has the North abandoned reunification, but an increasing number of South Koreans no longer want it either. And as this dream dies, it's getting harder to convince people to live here, on the front line of a conflict that might never be resolved.
Jean McKenzie reporting. And that's all from us for now. There'll be a new edition of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this podcast and the stories we included, drop us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. Or on X, we are at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Sharmini Ashton-Griffiths. The producer was Vanessa Heaney. The editor is Karen Martin. My name's Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
After Oppenheimer's success at the Oscars, why not delve into the history of the atomic bomb and key characters from that period of history with a podcast? The Bomb from the BBC World Service explores the race to beat the Nazis in developing the atomic bomb and the scientists and spies who changed history. Listen to the whole series now by searching for The Bomb wherever you get your BBC podcasts. After Oppenheimer's success at the Oscars, why not delve into the history of the atomic bomb and key characters from that period of history with a podcast? The Bomb from the BBC World Service explores the race to beat the Nazis in developing the atomic bomb and the scientists and spies who changed history. Listen to the whole series now by searching for The Bomb wherever you get your BBC podcasts.